Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on this edition of the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni. Today we begin with Jill Bevilacqua's weekly reflection, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, with readings by Sean Patrick Lovett.
Jesus went to his own part of the country, followed by his disciples. When the Sabbath came, he began to teach in the synagogue in a way that kept his large audience amazed. They said, Where did he get all this? What kind of wisdom is he endowed with? How is it such miraculous deeds are accomplished by his hands? Isn't this the carpenter, the son of Mary, a brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon? Aren't his sisters our neighbors here? They found him too much for them. Jesus' response to all this was, No prophet is without honor except in his native place, among his own kindred and in his own house. He could work no miracle there, apart from curing a few who were sick, by laying hands on them. So much did their lack of faith distress him. He made the rounds of the neighboring villages instead, and spent his time teaching.
Without naming it, Mark tells us here of a visit to Nazareth, our Lord's hometown, or rather village as it was then. Matthew, too, avoids using the name, whereas Luke states clearly that he came to Nazareth where he had been brought up. It may be only a coincidence, but as Mark is ghostwriting for Peter, and both Matthew and Peter would have been present on that occasion, could it be that they were too disgusted with the way Jesus was treated by the people of his own village to mention it by name? Speculation, of course, but perhaps worth considering. We're not told of how the disciples reacted to the behaviour of the Nazarenes, but one can imagine Peter, with his fierce loyalty, ready to take on anyone who offended the Master. But the evangelists are silent on the subject. Matthew writes only that he did not work many miracles there because of their lack of faith. Mark goes further, stating that he could work no miracles there apart from healing a few sick. This sounds odd, since these cures were surely miracles too, but they were probably not spectacular cures, such as the raising of the daughter of Jairus, which we heard of last week. And so the visit ends sadly, with Jesus distressed at their lack of faith. Metaphorically, he does what he's told the apostles they must do in such circumstances. He shakes the dust of Nazareth from his feet and goes to the neighbouring villages instead. When he first preached in the Nazareth synagogue, according to Luke, he won the approval of all, and they were astonished by the gracious words that came from his lips. But then Luke records a change in the mood of the listeners, and his account ends with the whole synagogue rising in fury and hustling him out of town and attempting to throw him over the edge of a precipice.
Although Jesus, passing through the midst of them, went his way, a tradition developed that he leapt from the mountain, although the exact mountain from which he leapt is not agreed upon.
And such is legend. Scholars believe that Luke has combined two separate events to illustrate the fate of the gospel, welcome and then rejection. How long did the welcome last, one wonders? On the first occasion, when Jesus read from the book of Isaiah, he announced that he was the one referred to in the scriptures. He it was who would bring the good news to the poor, liberty to captives, new sight to the blind, and so on. By the time he returned to Nazareth, he'd already fulfilled some of these promises. The Nazarenes would have heard strange things, and there would have been a certain curiosity, perhaps even a superstitious kind of hope, that he would perform some wonder among them. And as Luke writes, Jesus anticipates this thought when he says to them,
No doubt you will quote me the saying, Physician, heal thyself, and tell me, We have heard all that happened in Capernaum, do the same here, in your own countryside.
But the sceptics seem to carry the day, the sceptics and the snobs. Isn't this the carpenter? And a biblical scholar writes,
In the eyes of his fellow villagers, he's only a tekton, in Greek, a worker in wood, in stone or in metal, a general term to describe artisans, carpenters and masons. He is the son of Mary, a woman known in the village. It's the only time Mark mentions the mother of Jesus by name, and it's curious that the father's name is not there.
Luke, however, in his account, writes, "They said, 'This is Joseph's son, surely.'" But Joseph by this time seems to have been long dead, and Jesus had taken over the family workshop. Until one day, when he must have said something to his mother on the lines of, "I'm off now to be about my father's business." And off he went. How did his mother react? What happened to the carpenter's workshop? Did he pass it on to one of his relations, one of these brothers who are mentioned in the Gospel, cousin James or Joseph, perhaps? We don't know. And did he leave his mother just like that? Or did he come back now and then, incognito or at night, perhaps, to avoid meeting anyone he knew, until the time was ripe? A poet of our time, Tom Gunn, imagined what one of these meetings might have been like, with Mary doing most of the talking and Jesus speaking only one line, which is repeated throughout the poem, "I am my own and not my own." Here is a part of Jesus and His Mother.
"My only son, more God's than mine, stay in this garden ripe with pears."
"I am my own and not my own."
"I do not understand your words. I taught you speech. We named the birds. You marked their big migrations then like any child. So turn again to silence from this place of crowds."
"I am my own and not my own."
"Why are you sullen when I speak? Here are your tools, the saw and knife and hammer on the bench. Your life is measured here in week and week, planed as the furniture you make. And I will teach you like a wife to be my own and all my own. Yet I remember how you went to speak with scholars in furred gown. Are you the boy I bore alone, no doctor near to cut the cord? I cannot reach to call you Lord. Answer me as my only son."
"I am my own and not my own."
Well, that's just one man's imagined encounter of Mary and Jesus after his first departure from Nazareth to begin his public life. His mother would have known it would happen sooner or later, this breaking of the umbilical cord. Every mother knows that the moment will come when her fledglings will fly the nest. She might try to delay it, but she knows that eventually she must bow to the inevitable. It's all part of the natural pattern. Our children are only lent to us, as the Lebanese poet wrote.
"Your children are not your children. Though they are with you, yet they belong not to you. You may house their bodies, but not their souls. For their souls dwell in the house of tomorrow. For life goes not backward, nor tarries with yesterday. You are the bows from which your children, as living arrows, are sent forth. The archer sees the mark upon the path of the infinite, and he bends you with his might that his arrows may go swift and far. Let your bending in the archer's hand be for gladness."
A mother may grieve at the going of a child, but she will rejoice vicariously, for the child is going towards life. Mary, however, had been told at the temple presentation that a sword would pierce her heart. And although she'd accepted God's will right from the beginning, as Jesus grew to manhood, she must have felt more and more the shadow of that sword approaching. Sooner or later, her son would be leaving this domestic haven. For what? She could only leave it in God's hands, as she had always done. We're not told that Mary was present that day in the synagogue, only that the disciples were with him. And what about all the relations we hear about in the Gospel? Were they there? And who were they, anyway? A scholar reminds us that we hear of brothers and sisters of Jesus in various gospel passages. But, he writes,
These terms are not to be taken literally. The Jewish and Aramaic languages, in fact, don't have separate words for the varying degrees of kinship, so the words may mean relations in general, or cousins, as in this passage.
In a note to the Vulgate version of Matthew's account, we read that the brethren, or brothers, were the children of Mary, wife of Cleophas, sister to our Blessed Lady, and therefore, according to the usual style of Scripture, they were called brethren, that is, near relations to our Saviour. And in fact, if we go to John's Gospel, we may read that on Calvary there stood by the cross of Jesus his mother and his mother's sister, Mary of Cleophas, and Mary Magdalene. While in Matthew,
there were there many women afar off, who had followed Jesus from Galilee, ministering unto him, among whom was Mary Magdalene, and Mary the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of the sons of Zebedee.
Although John calls Mary of Cleophas Our Lady's sister, Sheed points out that that could apply to any close female relation, and he adds,
Hegesippus, who was born early in the next century, says that Cleophas was St. Joseph's brother, so that his wife would have been Our Lady's sister-in-law.
So there we are. You pay your money and you take your choice. One of the questions, the last in order, which we heard the crowd exclaim, was, aren't his sisters our neighbours here? And Sheed comments,
it looks as if the two families, Mary and Jesus, Mary of Cleophas and her children, were living close together, very much as one family, in Nazareth, perhaps after the deaths of Joseph and Cleophas.
But, as the same writer observes,
there is so much about all this that the evangelists do not tell us.
They were concerned with more important matters than family relationships. And what's important here is the reaction of the Nazareth synagogue. They found him too much for them. They would not accept him. And in yet another version, they took offence at him. To this last, a note runs.
Jesus' fellow countrymen would not accept the fact that the wisdom and authority of God was to be found in a humble artisan living among them, and whose cousins and whole family they knew well. This taking offence is unbelief.
And another writes, the Nazarenes were unable to grasp the value of his word or to see beyond the humble exterior of Christ. He could not do many miracles there, is the Vulgate version of Mark. And the footnote explains,
not for want of power, but because he would not work miracles in favour of obstinate and incredulous people who were unworthy of such favours.
In other words, Jesus was not going to cast his pearls before swine. And he exclaims bitterly,
no prophet is without honour except in his native place, among his own kindred and in his own house.
A prophet is only despised in his own country, runs the Jerusalem Bible version. And Luke writes, no prophet is ever accepted in his own country. What were our Lord's real feelings on this occasion, at this reception? He is amazed at their lack of faith. He wondered, marvelled at their unbelief. So much did their lack of faith distress him. The Gospel ends with Jesus making the rounds of the neighbouring villages, but Nazareth, his hometown, he puts behind him forever, as Bargellini writes.
From that moment, as he no longer has a real family, because he has chosen all humanity for his family, so he will no longer have a homeland, because his homeland will be the whole world.
On the purely human level, however, this cutting of ties must have generated in him that heartbreaking feeling all exiles have experienced at the moment of farewell, and an upsurge of nostalgia for all that home had been. The warmth of family evenings together, tools laid aside now, the quiet time after the simple meal and prayer, a sharing of the day's events. All this will now be consigned to memory. Some day, however, a voice or a scent will evoke that long-lost time when the Holy Family belonged to themselves alone. Music is one of the most powerful agents in this respect, and D.H. Lawrence reminds us of this common human experience in his poem Piano.
Softly, in the dusk, a woman is singing to me, taking me back down the vista of years till I see a child sitting under the piano, in the boom of the tingling strings and pressing the small, poised feet of a mother who smiles as she sings. In spite of myself, the insidious mastery of song betrays me back till the heart of me weeps to belong to the old Sunday evenings at home, with winter outside and hymns in the cozy parlor, the tinkling piano our guide. So now it is vain for the singer to burst into clamor with the great black piano appassionato. The glamour of childish days is upon me. My manhood is cast down in the flood of remembrance. I weep like a child for the past.
In the life of the Prophet of Nazareth, there will be no room for sentimentality or personal nostalgia. But the Son of God has a human heart, and one day, in the not-too-distant future, he will weep. Not for Nazareth, but for Jerusalem.
Thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua, who wrote and presented There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. And now we take a look once again at the past week's events here in the Vatican. Our resident Vatican expert Joan Lewis sat down with me to review some of the highlights of the past 7 days. Good morning, Joan.
Good
Welcome
morning.
Back.
They're cool inside, thank the Lord, but boy, you sure want to be on the shady side of the street these days, right?
Or in Castel Gandolfo.
Or in Castel Gandolfo, where the Pope is. But, you know, I mean, I look at the news from the U.S., and it's like, there's no way I'm going to stress how hot it is in Rome, because they're suffering enormously in such big parts of the United States, and especially where there was those huge unexpected storms last weekend that
right.
knocked down, it looked like a whole forest of trees, and people still, a million plus, without electricity.
Without.
Meaning, okay, you don't have air conditioning, you also don't have a refrigerator.
Of course.
And a freezer, and any of the other commodities of life. So anyway, we are all trying our best to remain cool. And you mentioned Castel Gandolfo because the Pope did go there Tuesday of this week. And
right.
so it's going to be a quiet summer, folks. The Holy Father for all of July does not have the weekly general audiences. And he did not, of course, I mean, this weekend, Wednesday. He will recite the Angelus at the inner courtyard of the Apostolic Palace. And then the weekly audiences begin in August. I think still at Castel Gandolfo, exactly.
Yes.
So he really, really loves that and prefers actually just to go there, stay there, enjoy the beautiful view. So you can understand why he likes to be out there and just also not going to some of the places in northern Italy that John Paul went to and Benedict did for a few years. It's like it's a double move. So anyway, we wish you the best, Your Holiness. I hope you have a wonderful, cool time. Enjoy those views. Enjoy the walks in the garden. Do it in the cool hours. And if you ever want company, you know where to find us. But so that'll be for a couple months, and then we do know the Pope is going. We'll get to that in a minute. He's going to Lebanon in September.
That's right.
His itinerary was revealed, and also announced, perhaps unexpectedly for some, but over the weekend, the prelate of Loreto, Archbishop Giovanni Tonucci, did announce that on Thursday, October 4th, the Holy Father will go to the Shrine of Loreto to entrust to the intercession of Mary the work of the Synod of Bishops in the Year of Faith, and the Synod will begin just days after that. And interestingly enough, this visit will take place to Loreto on the 50th anniversary of Pope John the 23rd's trip to Assisi by train. Now, Benedict will go by helicopter, but John the 23rd went to Assisi and Loreto.
Oh, he went to Assisi and Loreto.
Sorry, I forgot to mention that.
Okay. Loreto is in Le Marche region, isn't it?
And yes, I believe.
So
yes, it is.
It's south of Assisi. It's
it's a very small, you know, town itself. Obviously, the whole shrine
there's
is
a very
the
interesting relic there.
Dominant part of the town. So I just, maybe I'll go for a weekend and lay the groundwork for his visit. But also, this is this visit on the 4th is the 50th anniversary of, as I said, John the 23rd's trip to Assisi and Loreto, and that was the eve of the opening of the Second Vatican Council.
That's right.
So that will be nice. The Holy Father will have that little, you know, that'll be in October.
Meantime, activity is bustling away in the Vatican.
And things are calming down in general because, obviously, your curial stuff, once the Holy Father's away, then the other offices kind of feel like, okay, maybe we can go away too. So the heads of various dicasteries and a lot of the personnel, you may find some of the offices, which are, don't have huge staffs anyway, you may find a third to half of their staff away in July and then in August. No press conferences. And so the you know, immediate effect of that on us is a lighter schedule, which is very nice. It's time to catch up on other to catch up on projects you may have put on the back burner and research and things like that. So we did have the last papal event was, if you want to call it that, was the Angelus on Sunday. And the Pope spoke of the physical and spiritual healings. He spoke of the Mark's Gospel, where this the evangelist tells us about the two miraculous healings that Jesus performed in favor of women. One, of course, was the young daughter, I believe 12 years old, of Jairus, one of the leaders of the synagogue, and then the other was a woman who'd had hemorrhaging for about half of her life. And so the Pope spoke of physical healings, but he also spoke of spiritual healings, and he said the most important one, like for the woman who just simply wanted to touch Jesus' robe and she had a feeling she'd be cured. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you." And it was interesting because while the Pope emphasized both the physical and the spiritual healing aspects, he said these stories of healing are invitation for us to overcome our purely, I thought this was interesting, our purely horizontal and materialistic view of life. We ask God to relieve us our concrete needs, and the Pope said, and that's absolutely right, but we should ask him for a stronger faith and trust in his love and his providence that he will not abandon us. And then the Pope linked the healings in the gospel to those people who always seem to be around, and that's caregivers and doctors and nurses and those who do take care of the sick and help them carry their crosses. So
right.
He kind of was thanking your professional caregivers and healthcare professionals in that Angelus.
You mentioned earlier that the itinerary of his visit to Lebanon has been revealed.
It's very interesting because, I mean, he'll be there, if you look at the hours, a very short period. Now, Beirut is an hour ahead of Rome. The Pope leaves the morning of September 14th, and that is, he gets Beirut like 1:45 their time, local time. So I'm guessing he's going to eat on the plane because there's no mention of a meal with the bishops as he gets to Beirut. Then he'll go to Harissa. When he lands, he goes to Harissa. This is so beautiful, to the Basilica of St. Paul, and he'll sign the post-synodal apostolic exhortation, which is the whole reason for his trip. He will give that to the bishops at Mass on Sunday. Of course, the Pope will visit the shrine, the president of the country, prime minister and speaker. And it's very interesting. We won't go into these details today, but how by law each office has to be fulfilled by a different. So I think it's the president of the country has to be Christian. Then another one has to be a Shiite Muslim and another has to be a Sunni Muslim and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, there's a number of different luncheons scheduled. The Pope will meet with Muslim communities, address representatives of the government, the diplomatic corps, religious leaders, and the world of culture. And he will on Saturday address young people in front of the Maronite Patriarchate of Bekerke. And then he'll celebrate Mass Sunday at the Beirut City Center waterfront, consign the exhortation. After Mass, lunch with members of the entourage at the Apostolic Nuncture. That evening, then, there will be a prayers ecumenical gathering, and the Pope will leave for Rome.
It's the first time Benedict goes to Lebanon.
Yeah.
The last time was Pope John Paul II. Quite a
different circumstances. Well, we're hoping things are okay. I mean, Syria, the problems with Syria that are kind of overflowing into Lebanon.
Yes.
And again, we won't go into the politics too much of Syria's hand in governing.
But there are also thousands of refugees flowing, over the border in seek of safety. From
Syria. When I was
there
2 years ago, I visited, when I was in Iraq 2 years ago, on my way back, as I flew from Beirut to Erbil in northern Iraq. And so it was Rome to Beirut, and then I spent some time in Beirut after Iraq, and I met a lot of the Iraqi refugee communities and Palestinians, and so those are fascinating stories in themselves. The Holy Father could spend a week, as small mm-hmm. as Lebanon is. He could actually spend a week there if it was a question of visiting shrines, if it was a question of visiting, refugees. There's just so much history and church history there. And then you've got all these rites, Maronite, Melkite,
right.
and the Chaldean, less so, but they will be there, the Syriac. And so a fascinating trip with, you could have 10 people analyzing this trip, each one from a different point of view, and it will be a fascinating, a very rich trip.
Shall we just wrap up with a mention that Cardinal Bertone has been reconfirmed as Secretary of State?
Exactly.
In an official communique, shall we say.
Yes, the Pope, in a letter that he starts on the eve of my departure, and his departure was Tuesday, to spend the summer months at Castel Gandolfo, I express my profound appreciation for your discreet presence and wise counsel, which I found particularly helpful over recent months. And we know the scandal laden history of recent months and stolen documents. And then the Pope did mention, he said, having noted with sorrow the unjust criticisms that have been directed against your person, I reiterate the expression of, my personal esteem and so forth. And it's interesting because Cardinal Bertone did turn in his resignation, as church law demands, by heads of the dicasteries, by residential archbishops and so forth, at the age of 75. Now, this coming December, I think it's 2nd, he will be 78. So the Pope has reconfirmed and reconfirmed his presence. And interestingly enough, Cardinal Sodano, who was Bertone's predecessor, was in his position until the age of 78.
Oh.
So if in December, when he actually becomes 78, we should not be surprised
should the Pope decide
to accept his resignation.
Right.
So
he too has a right to
his Castel Gandolfo and
exactly.
a rest time. Exactly.
Thank you very much, Joan.
See you next week.
That's all from the English feature program today, but we'll be back at this same time tomorrow. So join us then. You can also listen to our programs on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English program. Laudetur Jesus Christus.